your host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDO Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me on today's show is my good buddy, Sean Shapiro. Sean, what's going on, man?
I'm pretty good. It's actually my son's my son's second birthday today. So
there we go. Well, congratulations to you and your son. Yeah. That's exciting.
So it's I'll pick them up from daycare a little bit later today, but earlier today we gave him a Hot Wheels like track thing, which me and his older sister may or may not have had more fun with this morning than he did. So it's a good day in the Shapiro household.
There we go. Well, hopefully we can make that day even better with this podcast we're going to do here. I'm going to read you a line that I read on someone's Substack recently. There are too many hockey podcasts. It's an oversaturated market. And if you don't have an established podcast in 2022, it's probably too late. Most podcasts are too long. When a podcast is an hour long, I start to worry about being able to commit to it, to listening to it. So I just rarely even start. Sean, who would say something like that?
That person clearly is misguided and lost and doesn't have an established hockey podcast.
Well, so here's the thing. We don't have to worry about that here in the Hockey PDO Cast because this is a 50-minute show these days.
Yes.
So
yes.
50 minutes falls under the hour-long mark. So I think it's not too long for anyone to commit. It's just the right amount. No, this will be a blast, man. I'm excited to catch up with you. It's been a while since we did a show together. I think the last time we did a show, you had moved on from covering the Stars, mm-hmm. but I feel like we still did a Stars deep dive. You're still my go-to Stars guy. It's funny, like in that market, Matthew DeFranks, who's leaving to cover the Blues soon, I had him on recently. I love the way he covers the team. You know, you go on down the line, Bob Sturm, I check in with him all the time. He's kind of a go-to for me. There's so much good Stars content. And then I do like shows about the Stars and people ask me like, why are you so obsessed with this team? And for a couple of years there, especially under Rick Bowness, it was a very fair question. This year, they've been much more exciting to watch. And we documented that when I did a Stars deep dive recently, but I'm still obsessed with the Dallas Stars.
Yeah. It's a team that has always been fascinating off the ice, even when the play on the ice sometimes was not so entertaining. And it's funny to see, like obviously Matt's a good buddy of mine and good to see him. I'm happy for him to be going. He's moving, doing a geographic move for family reasons. So happy for him, but he's going from one team that's, to be honest, a little less entertaining to cover. It's just at the end of the day.
well, I don't think it's a coincidence that the St. Louis Blues have, I think, won four in a row.
Oh yeah.
Almost dating back to Matt's,
It's the DeFranks bump. It's the, you know how everyone they won the Blues win the cup in 2019 and you couldn't read a single story about read a story without seeing something about they were in last place and interim coach. And so when they're in the playoffs this year, I expect every single major media outlet to look back to the DeFranks bump as the reason the Blues are turned everything around.
I love that. Let's talk a bit about Jason Robertson. I did want to discuss him because oftentimes, like I've written a bunch about him in the past, mm-hmm. and the stats that line puts up with him, Roope Hintz, and Joe Pavelski is so hilarious, both compared to the rest of the team, but also just pretty much every other top line. Like their on off splits are just continuously through the roof, and the rest of the team has played better this season, but they're still carrying so much of the weight. And whenever I tweet about Jason Robertson, he has a very big, passionate following, which is great. Yeah. And you love to see it. But then there's also this contingent that's like, man, no one this guy doesn't get talked about nearly enough. And it's interesting because I guess that's fair to say, because if, you know, he's so fun to watch, he does it in such a unique, different way compared to a lot of the traditional, pun intended, Stars in today's game, where it's such a speed oriented game. And so when you watch Connor McDavid or you watch Nathan MacKinnon, it's very easy for someone who doesn't even know anything about hockey to watch them and say, oh, I get it. This guy's really good. You can see that he moves faster than everyone else. He takes the puck on his end, from his end of the ice, goes coast to coast, goes through everyone, scores. yeah, that makes sense. When you watch Jason Robertson, his game is so much more nuanced in terms of moving off of the puck and kind of using his instincts and veteran savvy, despite the fact that he's so young and hasn't been in the league that long, to kind of get to the right spots and make it happen. And he plays off of Roope Hintz's speed so well. But his stats are so good that I think people might be right. Like, maybe we should be talking more about Jason Robertson. It hasn't quite gotten to the Alexander Barkov underrated yet. He probably still is, because he's a bona fide superstar and he's posting stats that are right up there with everyone. I'll give you a few. He's fifth in 5-on-5 points per 60. He's first in all situations point per 60, ahead of Connor McDavid. He's got 11 goals and 14 assists in his 16 games so far. And he's doing all of that after essentially punting training camp, right? Like, he was waiting for a new contract and he wasn't participating in all of the regular kind of gearing up to the season. And he's still doing this. So yeah, maybe we should be talking more about Jason Robertson.
Yeah, it's good that you brought up Barkov, because I was thinking about that myself as you were laying that out. It's like, at what point does he take over Barkov's throne as the mantle of, we'll have for four straight years, we'll have NHL players voting who the most underrated guy is, and it'll be Robertson all of a sudden, or people talking about that. I mean, Robertson's game, to me, the one thing that I love so much about his game, and I've written about this a little bit and I've talked about him, to me, and it's the reason that I feel like he's had so much success kind of even without training camp, is his game. He found success in Rick Bonus's system. He scored 40 goals with Rick Bonus as his head coach. Right. And I saw Dallas fans kind of freaking out, like, oh no, Jason's not signed. Is he going to, what's going to happen with the new system? He scored 40 goals in that system. Like, it's, you're not. And he's such a, like, I'm a big soccer guy. And so to me, he's kind of, Robertson has always been kind of like that guy who, like, the proto, like, number nine type in the number nine center forward in soccer, the guy who can disappear and just kind of float around the game and kind of do nothing for a while. And then there'll be that subtle moment where it could be a shot. It could be the way he moves to make space, where all of a sudden it changes the game. And that's something that lives up in his brain. It's a complete brain-based thing. And this is a guy who, when he was getting drafted, everyone in his draft year, myself included, one's writing and saying, like, oh, will he be able to skate in the NHL? Is the skating good enough? The skating. I'm like, well, you know what? Joe Pavelski's not a great skater. And
yeah,
he's at 38. He's still going. And it's, I love the, like, I was watching the Dallas game against Tampa the other night. One of the things I really liked about it was a goal by Marchment, but so often on the Marchment goal, I really liked something Robertson did, where you and I have both been John Klingberg defenders in the past, and the way he shoots the puck and the way he shoots the very tippable area shot. When obviously Klingberg's not having the greatest year with Anaheim, but
yeah.
Robertson's shot to set up Marchman's goal was very similar to that. Instead of being, a lot of times you get the forward in that space, right? And you get the guy who's ripping and gripping and aiming. And instead of doing that, Robertson just kind of adjusted and took, like, that kind of defenseman floating shot that was able to tip in. And that's the type of thing where it's going to look like, if you don't watch Jason Robertson every night, you're like, oh, that's a flubbed shot. That's intentional. And that's what I love about his game. Like, it's all up here. I mean, this is a podcast, so I'm pointing at my head, everyone, but like, it's funny too, to see kind of it. I love that he has a brother in the league who has to play a completely different way. Like, right. It's because Nick is a chaos on skates and Jason is the complete opposite.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of why, he's almost inextricable at this point from his line mates. First off, I think the three of them complement each other so well. I've discussed on this podcast in the past kind of how they almost, like, create this runway through the middle of the ice for Roope Hintz to use his speed to just skate through. And Pavelski and Robertson are so good at kind of working off the wall and extending possessions and giving them multiple opportunities. So it's not just purely a one and done rush attack for them. But I mentioned Robertson's fifth in 5-on-5 point rate. Well, Pavelski's fourth and Hintz is seventh. So, I mean, yeah, they're in a pretty good standing. All three of those guys get it done. And so I think that kind of ties into it. I think you hit the nail on the head, though. When you watch him, you could think, okay, this was a fluke, or, oh, that was unimpressive. But then if you watch enough reps of him, you realize that there's kind of a method to the madness, and there's a technique that he's repeating. And I think his feel for the game is almost unmatched, right? Like, you talk about a Mark Stone, for example, who does similar things, especially like defensively, despite not having great foot speed. Robertson's very similar, kind of that ilk of his ability to get to where he needs to be, despite looking like so lumbering and awkward sometimes when he's moving, is truly impressive and a sight to behold.
Yeah, and the other thing that he does so well that I really love about his game is that, like, obviously he feeds off that Pavelski and Hintz line are, the three of them work together tremendously well. The one unfortunate flaw with that line is one member of the line is 38, so we won't be able to see, like, there's not a massive runway for how long this line will be able to go beyond this season. But the other thing that I really like about Robertson is you see with him, it's not, obviously Pavelski and Hintz elevate his game, but he can do it in times when he has been on a different line or he has been with someone else. It's not completely built off who he's playing with. He can adjust and play well with anyone. And that's something that is not, that's, as much as anyone likes to say, oh, they're NHL players, they can do that. That's not the case. Not everyone can seamlessly move around like that. Obviously, Robertson is playing better with Pavelski and Pavelski and Hintz, but you see him play with Ben, you see him play with Sagan, see him play with anyone else, whether it's at 5-on-5 or another situation, he still fits. He still makes everything work and understands what needs to be done. And that's something we saw last year under Rick Bonus. It's something that haven't had to see as much this year because of how the Stars have been clicking and that line's been healthy. But in general, like, his adaptability, get my words right there. Yeah. His adaptability on everything is great. Like I mentioned, the Marchman goal before, where it's like, that's him and Marchman they're never on the ice together except for that power play situation. But it's still a area hockey's version of an alley oop that he throws up to him that he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you go. We're talking about Jason Robertson, and we're giving him the love that his game deserves. You know, he's playing on this 4-year, $31 million deal, which I don't want to necessarily call a bridge, because I think we generally associate that more with like 2 or 3 year deals where the money is incredibly low to make it work. Like, he's getting paid 7.75, which is a bargain still based on his production. But, you know, it covers his age 23 through 26 seasons. He'll still have the one more RFA year when it expires. And on the one hand, I imagine for the Stars, it would have been nice to just get him locked up for 8 years, because I feel pretty confident that he's only going to keep getting better and going to cost more. At the same time, I think that where this dialogue falls short is, would the player have wanted to take that contract, right? Like, if I was advising Jason Robertson, I'd say, probably should not be signing an 8-year deal at this point. If I were you, I would wait and kind of take this towards our unrestricted free agency. And also, you should mention the Stars, we're kind of up against it financially. And when that contract expires, they'll have a ton of money that's going to come off the books with Sagan and Ben and Suter and Vaxa and so on and so forth. But it's interesting that they went that route with both him and Ottinger, where they went 3 to 4 years on guys where it's going to cost them more on the back end of it, but they'll probably, like, it's not an indictment on them or like their place in the in the franchise's plans, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And it was, and knowing, obviously knowing a bit more about this negotiation, and from my understanding of it, the reason this took long, frankly, was Robertson wanted the 8 years. He wanted,
really?
His camp wanted things locked in. They wanted to be able to, but they wanted a level of money that they weren't going to get for 8 years. And so it became a push and pull. And it's something where, like, with RFA stuff, I always kind of laugh. And I know the Canadians and the Hurricanes have made offer sheets a real thing, but in general, people will always be like, oh, this GM's being slow on this, or this guy, like, it's at the end of the day, like, deadlines always make things happen, right? Like that's always the case, where Robertson basically missed off training camp, and at the end of the day, you know what, he still signed. Like, Jim Neal got him for the deal that Jim Neal probably would have signed him to 5 weeks earlier, but it's kind of the staring match in the game of how this goes. And I think Dallas was more, Jim Neal, I think, was a little more conservative with both Robertson and Ottinger in his thinking on this. Like, and it's something where he was thinking that, obviously, he's thrilled with what they're doing, but I think with how the Stars were looking at this, he was being a little more conservative of, like, I can't make 8-year bets that don't work out after how the Ben and Sagan contract have aged, or how the Lindell contract
well,
has
do you,
aged.
Do you really, think that was part of the rationale for Jim Neal? I mean, what are the realistic odds that he's going to be around 8 years from now covering this, running this team?
I think it's the rationale for the man who signs Jim Neal's checks.
Right. Yeah, that's fair. I think that person would probably want Jason Robertson here for as long as humanly possible.
And he would have, but he also didn't want to, Tom Gilardi, we can just say his name. Right. And Tom Gilardi has gone on the radio in Dallas before and kind of spoken out loud before about how he feels like, oh, these young players want to get paid before they've earned it. Like, he's said stuff like that before. And so I think it's a space where every GM, I always think fans need to remember this. Every GM's job is not necessarily to win the Stanley Cup. The GM's job is to try to win the Stanley Cup with the roster that makes their owner feel like they're happy.
That is fair. Yeah. I mean, I wonder, you know, there's been a lot of speculation. I don't know if you've heard anything about this from the chatter you had of, like, how much we should reasonably expect the cap to go up as soon as the next season. Like, the reports seem pretty varied. I keep hearing, like, general optimism, but I wonder if that's just partly, like, kind of like,
from a PR
perspective.
I feel like it's more general optimism. Honestly, I think I would not, if I was advising a player or an agent or whatever, there's a reason you hear this more from the league perspective, talking about the side. You don't hear the agents coming out and saying, oh, the number's going to get, like, agents aren't all of a sudden thinking that the cap increase is going to pop next year. It's something where we're talking the still, I think 2-3 years. It's maybe I'm wrong. I mean, but even the NHL has been rather honest, like these digital dashboards, right? Which conceptually it's fine, but obviously the application of them has been has left
okay,
a lot
we
to
need
be desired.
To, we need to talk about them.
Yes, we do.
Oh my god, the players just disappear, like limbs just disappearing into the boards throughout play.
Yes.
is it's wild that in 2022 it's this difficult to sit down and enjoy a hockey game on TV or on your laptop or on your phone or however you're streaming it. It's very upsetting, and I understand why it's happening, but acting like it's okay is, like, it's not.
It's, oh no, it's the application is terrible. It is absolutely awful. And that's why conceptually it was an okay idea, but conceptually it was an okay idea if the technology was working, and they ran this by test groups and everything like that. And I can only imagine the test groups were people that random advertisers brought in to look at things, as opposed to, I didn't get a call to be a part of this test group, so I don't know how many people were actually hockey fans that were looking at this. So it's, yeah, they are. But on that note, where I was going with that was, like, the NHL has even admitted, like, well, those aren't going to be a massive boom for the finances of the league. Like, there will be some more money in the Stanley Cup final because you'll have Canadian advertisers be able to actually get on the boards. Like right now, like you're sitting in Canada and you watch the Stanley Cup final between Colorado and Tampa. You're just getting all the American ad board ads, right? And you have big advertisers in Canada that basically were, because a Canadian team didn't reach the final, didn't get board ads. And so that's going to be a little bit of a bump, but the NHL hasn't even admitted to me, like, this is not a huge financial jump this year. And I see the league as far as how this goes and finances and jumping and everything like that. Like, I think Gary Bettman does a really good job of spinning things. So his 32 bosses, remember, he works for the 32 owners, his 32 bosses feel pretty happy about themselves. And that's what he's doing. And that's kind of how I look at it, because I have yet to see a real strong, believable statement from the PA or from a player's perspective where it's like, yeah, we're going to start see a $4 million cap jump next year. I don't see it, but.
Yeah. Well, the reason why I brought that up is because, you know, there's this an interesting push pull, which isn't necessarily new, but I think it's going to become heightened as cap dollars potentially go up. And as teams get smarter about aging curves and realizing that you want to be buying up UFA years ahead of time and taking that risk, because if it pops for you, it's like the biggest luxury you can have is a player who's either on an ELC or playing on like that second deal where they're producing much above the tax bracket they're actually in, right? The worst thing you want to do is being on the hook for a player in their 30s and paying them for their most productive years when they're not at that level anymore.
Yeah.
And I think from a player perspective, we've seen this happen in the NBA, for example, where there were a couple of massive cap spikes because of TV deals, right?
Yeah.
And what happened was you'd have star players who had previously signed long-term deals that all of a sudden were watching their peers who they feel like are inferior talents signing contracts that significantly exceed theirs because they're coming up for new deals and because they've timed it out better, as opposed to them where they just kind of took the first paycheck they could and then all of a sudden are locked into this and they kind of like resented it in a way, right? For a long time for Nathan MacKinnon, it worked out great for him. He won a Stanley Cup. Now he's been paid accordingly. But for a long time, we'd always talk like, oh, look at this avalanche model of getting Nathan MacKinnon signed to this contract and what a team value it is. And I think like after a while, he actually started showing this in his interviews where he was like, this isn't a good thing. Like, this is actually kind of annoying to me. And it's understandable that he would feel that way from a human element. So there's that interesting sort of balance between, you know, signing a player and the player realizing, hey, I should probably like try to work this so that I can time it accordingly to get paid what I think I deserve.
It won't happen with McDavid because McDavid learned how to be. McDavid modeled his personality and hockey persona after Crosby, and so Crosby wouldn't do that. But I would be fascinated to see when some superstar player breaks the mold of this. Because right now it's like, oh, you're a superstar, you're going to sign for 8 years, and it's always because people are like, well, longevity and everything like that. Like, I want to see the NHL, the big player. I wanted to see, like, I would have loved to see for hockey for MacKinnon to say, "Oh, I'll sign for 1 year," like because that's such an NBA thing where it's like, "Hey, I'll sign for 1 year. If it doesn't work, I can." Like, hockey players are so overly loyal and so overly committed to like, "Oh, let's get a long term deal with this contract and get this," and they're frankly signing with a GM and a coach who they will outlive. Like, at some point, I think we're eventually going to get a spot where maybe it's I don't even know who it's going to be, but it's not going to be McDavid, obviously, because he's got the long-term deal. But eventually we're going to have a big name player say, like, I'm going to sign a one-year deal off my ELC. My first UFA year, I'm going to sign a one-year deal and see what works.
Right.
And then that's going to open up the door for others to do it. Whoever does it the first time will do it. And there will be 50,000 columns all over the United States and all over the Northern United States and Southern Canada about how they're not putting the team first and how they're selfish, but it'll be great for hockey because it will open up, it'll set a better market for how these things go.
Didn't that kind of happen a little bit with Austin Matthews' 5-year deal coming off his ELC? I remember at the time there was a bit of blowback of people being like, wow.
But by hockey standards, I want to see Austin Matthews when his 5-year deal ends, sign a 1-year deal. It'll be like, okay,
right.
I'm gonna go here, try to win a cup here. If it doesn't work, I'm open to do whatever in the next year. Like, I think that's something where I'd like to see that become at least part of the thing. I'm not against guys signing long-term. I'm not against it at all, but I think the sport and the market becomes better when superstars realize what they're worth and are realized to push it, because it's the same thing where when you have McDavid signed for as much as he does for as long as he is, it becomes a natural thing where anyone who makes even close to that, you're like, well, Connor McDavid makes that. Who do you think you are? That's just hockey ethos that comes into play. And I want that gone.
Right. Well, think about, with it'll be very interesting to see. I think David Pastrnak is going to get paid what he deserves. But for the longest time for the Bruins, it was like, well, Patrice Bergeron makes this amount. He's our captain. Yeah. Or I guess he wasn't. It was just Daniel Chara for a while. But like, he's our best forward. You can't go into that room and be making more than him. So you have to take less. And it's like, I mean, I understand why the team would want to push that agenda. But
yeah.
It's a pretty tricky one. And also, it's like, that's not how real life economics work, like, right? Like a contract you sign today cannot be compared to something that's signed next year because inflation and all that. But all right, Sean, let's take a break here.
Yeah.
And then we can pick it back up and we can talk about a variety of other things as well. So we're going to take that break here and then pick it back up. You are listening to the Hockeypedia Cast, streaming live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're back with more of the Hockeypedia Cast here with Sean Shapiro. Sean, before we went to break and I cut you off so rudely, you were making the smartest point that we ever heard. So please continue.
Well, that's a big buildup there. Now, we're talking about the space where players are going to start realizing that they need to get paid earlier in their careers, and because they're going to realize it before teams realize it. Because players and agents are going to be like, we have to get paid now because teams are going to start being on the cheap in that second, that deal. If you're 26, 27, why are you going to pay for that now? And I think where it's going to become, the interesting thing that it's going to become, and it's kind of started to happen, but we still have too many contracts left. It just starts to change the construction of the financial stature of what a roster is, right? Like forever, it was like, okay, we can go spend for a veteran for a third line center. That used to be a thing. And it still is but I think this kind of keeps pushing things even further where you're going to build around four or five guys, probably of those key positions, that top defenseman, that top center, your goalie, you're probably going to have those guys. And then the rest, it's going to just become more and more of a league where the market for your third line center, it's either going to be some guy in an ELC or you're going to be the veteran who's like, okay, you got to accept. This is just where it becomes. You're no longer going to be making $3 million to be a third line center. It's going to be, that's a $1 million job now. And that just becomes something where it's like, we've been talking about Dallas, like the Radek Foxa contract, like that is aged incredibly poorly. Like him making $3.25 million per year for his role is, you look at that and you're like, this is a mistake. And I think examples like that, and with players realizing, I think players are going to realize this before teams do. It's kind of like a chicken or the egg thing. And I think the players are going to start demanding more money earlier, which is going to lead to the teams reacting. It's going to happen one way or the other, but I think it's going to be player driven more so than team driven, as far as when you kind of the trickle down economics, to use big terms here, I guess.
Yeah. Well, the strange thing for me is, something we don't consider very often is the ownership element of like actually signing off on a lot of these transactions, or what the motivations are. And then occasionally, as you mentioned with the Stars, like owner does like a podcast or a radio interview and speaks his mind. And you're like, oh, All right. Well, maybe it's good that we don't hear from these guys all that often.
Yes.
But,
yes.
You know, here in Vancouver for a long time, and I think deservedly so, especially in terms of the way they acted around and during the pandemic, there was a big issue or people were concerned with how the Aquilinis were running the team from like a cost-cutting perspective and whether they were being cheap and all this. But then at the same time, they were entrusting Jim Benning to just light money on fire every free agency. And and trying to like put those two thoughts together where it's understandable that even a very rich person would not want to be wasting money and would want to be involved with like how how their team is spending their money, but then trusting like a former player or whatever to that doesn't actually have like business acumen to be just doing wild stuff with that money. It just seems so wild to me to kind of put those two thoughts that are so divergent together. And that's what happens with a lot of these teams.
I mean, what other, it's not just a hockey problem. It's a pro sports problem in general, but we see it obviously a ton in hockey. Like what other business model would you allow someone who has zero business experience to step into making vital decisions about how your things are going to run day to day? Like, and some, you know, some GMs, some former players have done great and some have, but there's also so many examples where you're like, did we really do our due diligence here? Was this the best option? And it's a thing where just because you played the game doesn't mean you're the most qualified person to coach the game or manage a team. And I don't know if that will, that's the thing where like, that's one of those where you're always like, I hope that will change someday. I don't know how well that will change because it's someone being, taking someone, an owner being brave and treating their team like their primary business. And too many owners treat like it's their rich person hobby as opposed to their primary business.
Right.
And I think that's one of the biggest things. And so many of these teams are owned by someone who made money doing something else. And they're like, okay, well now I own a sports team and this is cool. And I can kind of let it be. And owners don't treat their teams like their primary. They treat it like their hobby and they try to, and they wouldn't run their hotel chain or their catering business or whatever, or hedge fund managing or whatever. They wouldn't run it this way.
Yeah.
They wouldn't run their primary business that way, but they run their sports team that way. And it's, I wonder if eventually that starts the one owner who you think about who actually runs his team like his primary business and he gets a lot of flack for it is Tom Dundon. Mm-hmm. Tom Dundon runs the Hurricanes in a similar way to he runs any other business. And he gets flack for that. And that's
well, here's the thing, Sean. I think for running an NHL team from like a GM perspective, there's so many specialized skills that you need to effectively do the job that I think it's almost unrealistic to expect one person to be able to do all of those things. Right. So what winds up happening is everyone needs to check their ego at the door and you need to acknowledge your limitations. And then the owner needs to shell out enough money to hire 3, 4, 5, 6 people to combine to do that job, which seems much less palatable than entrusting just one person and paying one paycheck out to do everything. And then you wind up running into these mistakes. And it's like, oh, well, you know, of course this person messed up. And it's like, yeah, we probably could have seen this coming and maybe we should change the model that we use.
Yeah. And I wonder if maybe we're seeing the seeds of that with this, the rise of the director of hockey operations, right? Because like we now have like president of hockey operations is essentially, it's what they did in Vegas, it's what they did in Colorado, where they basically made someone a president of hockey operations who's technically above the GM, even though the GM is technically the person who makes decisions. And I wonder if maybe that's the groundwork and the foundation that maybe leads to more of this larger brain. You see it in places here and there. Like you see teams now have, I was down at last week, I was down at the Five Nations tournament in Plymouth, and I ran into a, I want to make sure I got the right Siglet right. There's two brothers, Jordan and Jonathan. I think it's Jordan is the goalie coach for the.
Just Jay. Let's just go with
Yeah,
Jay.
Yeah. But for the Calgary Flames, and he used to be the Flames goalie coach, and now he's the director of their goaltending department. And the fact they have a full goaltending department is great, because that means all of a sudden you have more people focusing on one position and everything right. like that. And that's great. And I think kind of it can start with goaltending. It can start, like, Florida has their whole goaltending division.
Goaltending excellence. Yeah, Department of Goaltending Excellence, I believe. Yeah.
I think it starts there, and then eventually it comes down to some major ego checks at the top when some team's going to do, hey, we need this to be a full trust, as opposed to the guy who's sitting in the GM meeting or whatever. So,
yeah. All right. On my notes here of stuff that I wanted to talk to you about, I mean, I had a bunch of random stuff. I wanted to talk about broadcasts. I wanted to talk about watching games in 2022, reverse retro jerseys. I think we should get into the idea of creating new content, because that's something I think you're exploring with quite a bit on your Substack, right? Kind of trying new ways to provide information that's new and interesting and fun and easy to consume, right? And that's something I think a lot about now. You know, I do this show Monday to Friday daily. It's much provided. I mean, it's been a very rewarding experience, and the listeners have been great and all that, but it's coming up with new ways to talk about stuff or bring up new material, as opposed to just regurgitating the same thing over and over again. That's something I'm really interested in. I've wanted to explore getting more, tapping into the brains of players. That's something I'm very interested in, right? So you used to cover the Stars on a daily basis. You're around the team, you're building relationships with them. I've started to do so myself. I don't cover any team, but, you know, players sometimes reach out asking about this or that, or wanting to learn more about analytics. And then that's kind of like a good entry point to building this stuff. And I understand that for most players, there's no real reward in going on a podcast or sitting down and doing a video show where you're kind of giving away your tricks of the trade, or you're giving away secrets in terms of what you see on the ice or how you prep or how you do this or that. But I do wonder, as we move along here, it's 2022, it'll almost be 2023, as players start to see other former players having success on broadcasts or jumping into media and kind of, you know, creating a whole new shelf life of their career for themselves doing so. If you're a player towards, like, getting into your 30s and you kind of see the ticking clock for your playing career and you're wondering, what am I going to do next with my career? It feels like it would be a pretty nice, like, little entryway there. I say that selfishly. I would love to be a vessel for that. But I do wonder, like, if we'll see players start to kind of embrace that more and not be so rigid or not be so, like, secretive about everything as it relates to the game. And I don't know. Well, how do you feel about all that?
I had a really interesting conversation with, I had an interesting conversation earlier this week with someone from a more traditional media outlet about potentially doing some work with them on something here or there. And one of the things that this person lamented to me was the whole fact of, like, well, we used to be big capital M media, right? Mm. We used to be the only line to the players, right? Like, it used to be like, and now it's become this space where even if the players don't do it, it's the teams have started to channel that way, where it's like the whole, I don't know who the first social media person is that came up with the little silly little microphone thing. Like, every single team does it now, where it's like guys walk off the ice and they got one question. Like the fact of the matter is, like, that used to be that little, like, TikTok length video of, like, what's your favorite Christmas holiday, right? Like, what's your favorite Christmas holiday? Holy crap, that's a terrible question. The little tip.
Yeah, Christmas, favorite question Christmas movie.
What's your favorite Christmas movie or whatever? And that used to be, like, all of a sudden, that right there used to be, a reporter's notebook, right? That's a whole reporter's notebook where you're like, oh, I talked to the entire team and got their favorite Christmas movie. And all of a sudden now the team is just giving it out in 30 seconds.
Right.
And it's becoming more and more of a space where this is a weird industry we're in, that we're figuring this out. And it's something where, personally, I'm trying to figure out some things too, that like some things that work and some things that don't. It's one of the things that I've noticed, like, that you have with players now. I think players are controlling more of what they share and everything like that. But I think one place where I've noticed that I've really still continue to find a way to connect players to fans is players have grown up and lived in this insulated hockey player environment for so long.
Yep.
And so, like, I did something on the Substack last week on Mo Sider's game day routine, just because, like, I was watching from the press box, and every single pregame during the warmups near the end, Sider basically takes in his from his knees, just starts juggling two pucks, just kind of like by himself near the blue line. And I was like, that's interesting. I'm curious. We talked about that as routine. We talked about past the game, and that's the type of thing where Mo Sider doesn't realize that's interesting to anyone else. That, right. I think that's kind of the space where we start to go further, as well, players will continue to be more media savvy and share things and everything. I still think there's the kind of that gap, and it's kind of a place I plan to try to live with my career for an extended period of time, hopefully, where there's a space where they don't realize what's interesting to them. They don't realize that they don't right. realize their status as someone who is a celebrity or person of interest. Like, I had like, for example, in Detroit here, so Matt Luff takes the 16, gets the stick up, gets the puck up onto his chin, and has 8 stitches inside, 8 stitches outside, and literally leaves an indent on the mouth guard. Like, Matt Luff is a hockey player. Everyone else in that locker room is like, okay, you took a puck to the teeth. That's literally not a big deal.
Yeah.
To anyone else in that locker room. But to all of a sudden people who don't take pucks to the teeth every day, like you and I, and all of a sudden you're like, wow, that's got to hurt. And the fact that then just though the fact that I don't know if players, and maybe in some way, but I don't know if players will ever really truly realize the power they have, how interesting their life is. And as long as they don't realize that, I think there's still a good for someone like me. The other thing, when you talk about content, that I think is just that's changing every day, and it's just kind of, I think it's more and more a key question of what do we want to consume from games anymore. I think right. Another thing, just like if and that's the challenge that I've tried to figure out. Like, when I was on the Stars beat, I had my game day 2020, which I was very proud of, and how it went and everything like that, and it was really thorough and everything like that. And but at the end of the day, all sports fans are fair weather fans in a way. Like, you would see, like, oh, they won a game, and you'd see the numbers, and people would read, and you'd be like, oh yeah, this is a great idea, do it every game. They lose 3-2 at even a great game, and the amount of people reading would be about half that. And so you start to look at and figure out this space of what do people actually want from a game? If a team loses, do you even write anything? And luckily, I'm not in a spot where I'm a beat writer that has to cover it that the way I used to anymore. So I don't have a newspaper deadline to worry about that. But like, that's why, for example, I tried something on the Substack this week where we'll see if it works. I don't know, but where I did the whole, like, okay, I took the Detroit Anaheim game and the Dallas Tampa game from Tuesday night, and just basically kind of went Monday morning quarterback. I actually texted our pal Bob Sturm just about it, because he does a little bit, some of the stuff football wise, where I basically just took a look at all the goals and just asked a simple question. Why did that go in? And it's something where it's like, okay, that's the type of thing where I didn't write a game recap. I didn't write this is what this means. It was just taking a simple question of like, okay, why did that puck go in the net? And why did that puck go in the net? And it seems that that's what people wanted. And I'll go with that. Maybe it works. Maybe it doesn't. It's the whole content versus story is the line is getting so blurred. And I know I've rambled, but
well, no. Well, here's the thing. Like, I think the post gamers are a great entry point in this conversation because they sort of summarize my thoughts on this. Where for the longest time, it kind of used to be this cookie cutter thing that would just the question you're trying to answer is what. Right. It would be like, what happened in this game? And you would just like give facts of like this player scored. And then, you know, this was the score line at that point. And then someone took a penalty and then this and that. It's like just giving a summary. Right. And I think right now there are a lot of fans that are interested. I'm sure a large percentage listening to this show, because that's why they listen to the BDO cast. Cause that I'd like to think we provide a bit more thoughtful outside the box content. That are interested in the how and the why, especially from like a schematic perspective, because we get so little of that. We always talk about how hockey is such a fast, chaotic sport. The puck is bouncing around, going back and forth. People are running into each other, like this and that. But there is an underlying X's and O's component of like the play broke down here. And if you can identify that and show someone who might not be able to capture it in real time because it is moving so fast, that can all of a sudden help explain so much of what happened in the game, and it almost answers the what in a much better way than just giving a straight up synopsis of the final result, basically.
Yeah, I feel like the box score has completely replaced the recap. Like, it used to be something where I think people would be like, okay, well, I'll still read the recap because it would give me something. But now I think people have just accepted I'm smart enough to, like, I can write. It's if you put an NX score in front of me, I could write you a 500 word recap, like, literally right now. Be like, I could literally be like, oh, so-and-so scored at 5:20 of the third period, and team A beat team B 2-1 to extend a 5-game win streak. X name goalie made X amount of saves, including 12 in the third period. Like, I could literally write that right now based off just looking at a box score. And that's so many box scores you read. You could look at it and you're like, I got nothing from someone actually watching the game. I just basically got someone reciting stats to me for 500 words.
Yeah, like, if you're an outlet, why would you send someone to a game to do that when, like, you could probably put together some sort of a bot that could just regurgitate from the box score what actually happened. I don't know, it's ridiculous. All right, Sean, let's talk a bit about your Substack then and plug some stuff, because we gotta put a bow on this and bring it home. So let the listeners know kind of what you've been working on. You already mentioned a bunch of the pieces, but where they can find it and all that good stuff.
Yeah. So the Substack's name is Shapshots, the lovely alliteration there. The site itself is just seanshapiro.substack.com. Some point, probably, if things go financially well enough, maybe we buy an actual domain, but that's steps down the line. Essentially what it is, and so I'm based in the Detroit area. And I have a season credential for the Wings, and I'm at most Wings games, but I kind of look at it as a space where it's kind of like my sandbox to have some fun and write about hockey. And obviously I've got another gig now where you and I are working together in with the fine folks at EP Ringside, and definitely want to give them some love, but kind of the Substack is kind of, it's my sandbox to have some fun. It's where there's going to be a lot of Stars stuff. There's going to be a lot just because of my history covering that team. And I've got a lot of readers from there. There's definitely there's going to be some Red Wings adjacent things because of my location. As I tell people, I'm not a Stars or Wings beat writer. I'm just a writer that happens to write about those teams quite a bit. And then it's also a space where I'm still doing a little bit of covering some of the things that from my old gig that, some of the parts that I still enjoyed. Like, I think like on Monday this week, I wrote about the whole PK Subban and ESPN thing and called it Medium Monday. And we'll see if that's once again, more alliteration. Well, we'll see. And I think there tends to be interest, I realized, from hockey fans to understand a little bit more about how this game is covered. And it's something that just doesn't really, not many other people talk about it. Like, you and I have had these conversations, but in general, it's kind of one of those spaces where it's like anyone who's covering media in the United States is looking at football and basketball. And,
right.
And I think there's a space there where we have some fun with that. Like, for example, just kind of looking at the whole Subban hire, like, I think the Subban hire is great for ESPN. I think it's also something that they need to learn lessons from it, because there's some of their talent is clearly miscast.
Yeah.
And being able to write about that and having some freedom to do that. And the other thing that I love about the kind of just the, that's been fun about the, that format is we've been able, I've been able to kind of just jump into some things that I find interesting that I really, before when I was working somewhere else before, and I kind of had a defined job and everything like that, like I got to write about, I got to talk to Oli Mata about Apollo. Okay. Right. Like, so anyone who doesn't, Best Apollo is Finnish baseball. And that's the only reason I say baseball is because that's the closest possible thing. Anyone wants to YouTube Pes Apollo, it is basically a ball gets tossed in the air. There's a bat, but instead of running a diamond like you imagine, you're running left and then right. There's multiple designated hitters and there's a river in play sometimes. And Oli Mata's dad played professional Pes Apollo. And I got Oli Mata to explain Apollo to me. And I'm like, that's cool. It's interesting. And that's the type of stuff we do at the Substack, where it's just, we have some fun. We write about what's interesting. And it's also always open to the other thing I like about it. And I think this is something that you personally would understand really well on this stuff is it's not as much about appealing to what should be done. And this is how things have been done. It's more about appealing to what does readership want and how, and what do they find interesting? And I think that's something where I think, imagine you personally, I kind of understand that, where it's like, this is not, it can evolve and that's okay.
Yep. Yeah. Well, Sean, you've been killing it. I definitely recommend everyone goes check that out, and we're going to have you back on the show plenty. As the season goes along here, you're going to become our media/business correspondent. How about that?
There you go. Good time. All right.
So this is awesome, man. Be well, and we'll check in with you soon. Thank you to the listeners for listening to the Hockey PDOcast. If you enjoyed it, as always, you can help us out by smashing that 5-star button, leaving us a nice little review wherever you listen to the show. All that's greatly appreciated. And we're going to be back tomorrow with a Friday mailbag, as we do every week. So looking forward to that. So thank you for listening to the Hockey PDOcast here on the Sportsnet Radio Network.